Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. Today is episode 109 with the title Beyond Binaries. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Cynthia Fortledge. Cynthia is an award-winning gender diversity speaker, consultant, and writer. And when I asked Cynthia to describe her superpower, she said she's one leader with two genders of experience. Hello, Cynthia. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Joe. Thanks so much for having me on the show. I'm excited to be here with you today.
Fabulous. So, Cynthia, beyond the binaries and your superpower, tell me more.
Well, you know, the work that I do today with organizations is focused on really dealing with all of the issues that cover the space of gender diversity. And it's not gender identity. It is how diverse gender is. And, you know, I talk about, from a historical perspective, you know, 10,000 years of understanding language and history, where clearly 10,000 years ago, cultures knew that gender was not binary. Yet we obviously have a lot of conversation today about, quote, you know, the binary of gender, when in fact, it's actually not. Even though in my own personal story, I always describe it as, quote, flipping my binary, because that was what was right for me. And that insight coming from the place where I was, which was when I came to this life epiphany, I was a C-suite working executive overseeing technology for a international organization in North America, hence my accent. And that journey to where I am today has been strewn with a whole bunch of leadership roles and responsibilities. In fact, it may interest the audience to know that I actually learned to fight for women's rights before I ever learned to fight for LGBTQ+ or trans rights. And that very much influences the lenses by which I look at the challenges that organizations face. And those challenges that I talk about are not just within the LGBTQ+ or trans space, but the issues that impact women that, again, relate to, for 2.5 years, I was learning to fight for women's rights across all of Canada, not just the LGBTQ+ ones, but all women. And therefore, when I became national leader of that organization, I was bringing a voice to all of women's issues. And so that gives me a very unique insight as well. Also, the fact that I have never met another C-suite level executive who has transitioned on the job. I'm still looking. I've met senior people, but never someone who's actually has a C-suite role as I did. And there's some very unique characteristics that I find come with that role that gives me a unique insight into corporate organizations, and especially at the leadership level, that really needs to be factored in when we talk about roles and responsibilities of leaders. And what does that look like when we talk about corporate cultures and how that transforms? So I've been very fortunate to do this work since about 2017. And I've been fortunate to deal with almost 500 companies in over 30 different countries to date. I am based here in London in the UK, and I am slowly growing my network and my connections and be able to speak with diversity specialists, HR specialists, and those that may have challenges within their organization where gender is impacting their employees, and they're just not sure what the next step forward is. And I bring that depth and breadth of insight in order to help those organizations move forward.
Fantastic. You talk about gender. So for our listeners, how would you define the term gender? What does that mean? Because there's lots of misunderstandings around sex, around gender. So yeah. What is gender?
Well, I mean, let's break down what it's not. It's not what today people use the term sex to talk about, quote, biological sex, which the inference is genitalia. And the whole idea is it's not that. That is one aspect. I describe sex as an act between, you know, two consenting adults. So we have that aspect. So gender is the innate sense of who we are, but also how society perceives us and puts upon us the roles and expectations of that perceived gender. So in my case, I normally get treated as a woman in society, which is how exactly I see myself. And therefore, I see that as in alignment. But that also means that the oppression that women in the corporate space and in everyday life, you know, encounter is the same experience that I have. And so this idea of gender is not fixed based upon a body part. It is centered on ourselves, of how we see ourselves, but also how others are seeing us from a societal level. And of course, corporate cultures are a microcosm of societal cultures. And I don't believe I can, quote, change an entire society. So I work with organizations to try and change and help them change one at a time.
You talked about this concept of gender being innate. It's not our sex as such. It's how we see ourselves, how the world sees us, how we align. Mm-hmm. There's also another phrase I've heard, social construct, and that's applied to gender. So how would we marry a gender and social construct together? What does that mean?
Great question. The key is to realize that a social construct is, of course, something that doesn't actually exist. It's being created by society who believes it to be true, but it's actually not. And I'll give you a couple of simple examples. The first is, prior to the 1940s, every baby that was born was put in a pink blanket, pink. Yet today, when we talk about colors, the idea that pink is for girls and blue is for boys is a social construct. It's not true. Somebody made it up and somewhere it stuck, probably through the introduction in terms of in the hospitals. But, you know, that's just one example. Another is that, you know, when we refer to children and we refer to boys and girls, well, if you go back into 1800s and before, the fact is within, you know, households having slaves, the word boy was used to refer to a male slave, not to a male child. In fact, all children had a form of girl, is what they were called. So society has advanced language. We have changed the use of that language. We've repurposed the word boy to describe a male child in this case. And along the way, we have somehow come to believe that these have always been, when in fact, many of these things have only existed within the last few hundred years, probably within 600 or less years. But when we talk about the societies of human beings, we talk about histories that are 10,000 years old or older. So they're not new. And it just shows that language is ever changing. And therefore, our social understanding of what these words mean is also constantly changing.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the work that I often refer to as the gender box. And this is kind of societal's role expectations of one's gender. And it has a lot of rules, doesn't it, the gender box? It mm-hmm. says, well, if you're a woman, you must behave like this. If you're a man, you must behave like that. And the thing that I always think about is that I always think of gender as proportionate or directly entwined with time, space, as civilizations, so that the expectations of that gender box for a man, for a woman, for whatever,
right,
is different today in 2024 than it was in 1824, 1724.
Yeah.
Different in China, different in India, different in Saudi Arabia, different in North America. So
exactly.
It's the construct we've created within the society we're living in right now, isn't it?
Oh, it is completely. I mean, you know, to take your example a little further back, if we look at Cleopatra, who was a pharaoh in Egypt, yet pharaoh was an assumed male role. So how was this woman all of a sudden had this role as pharaoh, right? It was completely counter to their time, to the change. But, you know, the other aspect is that when we talk about these aspects and thinking that everything is binary, black and white, you know, one, two, on, off, whatever version of a binary acronym that you want to think of, ones and zeros for those that are in the computer industry. The reality is that what people keep forgetting to factor into this conversation, if you black out kind of all the perceived aspects and only focus in, say, from a biological perspective, because a lot of people go there. The challenge is, from a biological perspective, absolutely everybody I talk to forgets the intersex community. Now, intersex people represent about 2% of any country's population. Now, the key is many of them do not know they're intersex until they actually have a medical encounter that requires the discovery, usually from a genetic analysis, that they're intersex. Now, that means that out of the about 7 physical characteristics that are biological in our body, within the intersex community, they are completely varied. And you know what? It makes complete sense, because when we look at all aspects of a human being, you know, tell me what aspects are binary. Because when we talk about whether it be skin color or hair color, eye color, we talk about our height, our size, but we're not this homogenous binary group. We are so diverse and the spectrum is so wide that at the end of the day, the fact is that biologically, we are very diverse. And from a human being perspective, that is represented within the intersex community, that shows that all of these aspects assumed to be binary, in fact, are not. And from there, we add on the layers of people's innate sense of identity, as well as components of sexuality, the privilege that comes with that. When we talk about power and privilege from an allyship perspective, but, you know, how are people oppressed, which is how are they perceived within societies? And all of these factors may be seen or unseen. You know, we are faced with helping folks wake up to the fact that this is so much of a spectrum when it was originally perceived as simply a binary. Yet that's only in the last few hundred years, not in the totality of the existence of human beings. And the reality is that it's not that more people are becoming known as that. And everybody uses the study, you know, of left-handedness, where at one point it was illegal. And then it was considered, well, if you write or use or dominate with your left hand, then, you know, then you are, you know, working with the devil. And that's the devil's hand. And when we got rid of all of those societal bias of perceiving those things as untrue, and they were just a way to classify and box a particular part of the population, there was an increase, quote, in the people that identified as left-handed when it was perfectly legal to do so, and they weren't necessarily shamed as such. And when they did that, the numbers plateaued out, and they plateaued out around the 10% mark. And so we know that within probably a number of these aspects, there's probably, quote, the population about 10% fit in. So when we talk about, for instance, the LGBTQ plus community as a whole, you know, based upon the 2022 census in the UK, that represented about 9.2% of the population. So it's kind of there, you know, so to say that the entire population of gender diverse people is strictly the 0.5% that was quoted is probably an understatement, but it's probably an understatement that some people just didn't feel safe enough in order to make that declaration. And I certainly remember my own personal journey that was not a simple journey to get to that point before I could ever literally utter those words. It didn't happen till I was 50, and I did not see myself represented. When I looked in a mirror, I did not see myself reflected till I was 52 years old.
Just picking up on something, another phrase you said earlier is gender equity. I mean, I look back, obviously I'm not this old, but I look back through history, and we see that men, women, male, female, in terms of sex, in terms of gender, I mean, have had very kind of fixed rule sets imposed on them. And there's almost been a concept that men are superior and women are less or are inferior. Mm-hmm. And that's been kind of reinforced in the gender roles that have evolved to where we are now, but maybe even more apparent with the Disneyfication of gender, you know, the Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs view of the world. But we wind that back to Victorian times in the UK and beyond. Mm-hmm. There's very fixed rules about women were incapable or perceived incapable of doing certain roles, weren't they? So where did that come from, do you think?
Well, I mean, you know, to your point, all we have to simply look at to understand what even that, you know, Victorian era and that, just look at the movie Mary Poppins. It very much demonstrated those expectations. You know, Mr. Banks was a banker, right? And his wife was bucking the trend, and she was fighting for the right to vote. Yet if we trace back the history of when did all of these things kind of change, it really correlates with colonization. And, you know, the realization that colonization on its own, which, you know, the UK and England was not the only country colonizing the world. But when those colonizers went into these foreign lands where they had much different understanding of gender, they also brought religion, and it was reinforced within religion. And so when we talk about colonizers, we really can't separate it from the conversation of a religious understanding or limitation. Now, when we talk about that, I've got my own unique history with it. I was born in Belfast, Northern Ireland, and I was a Protestant. But, you know, unfortunately, the troubles in the early 70s chased my family away. And so I grew up in Canada, where I acquired this wonderful accent. And in doing so, I ended up meeting this wonderful person, and we got married, and I converted to being a Catholic. And in fact, I was so much a Catholic, I even taught catechism to adults. Now, that showed me, A, the huge amount of similarities that were brought between, even though there was really just, you know, kind of a couple of the aspects of how each group practices the religion that separates them, but they were generally very similar. When we start to go backwards in time, if we look at, well, today, a lot of people want to quote the books they use. Well, which book is that? Because you end up having, of course, the Old Testament. Well, the Old Testament is the Jewish Torah. And, you know, then we have the New Testament that was put together. You know, and if we talk about from a Muslim faith perspective, not only is it the culmination of the Torah, there is no New Testament to it. So it's the Torah and aspects of the Old Testament from the Christian Bible along, you know, with their own specific, you know, historical practices. And when I see that happening, it's like, oh my gosh, like the similarities of the points of origin. And these books are not a single book. They are a culmination of many different writers from many different lands creating the stories, recalling the stories, not in the moment in time. Some of it was hundreds of years later. And the fact is that we know that through the Dead Sea Scrolls and so forth, that through a number of finds, there have been multiple, quote, of these chapters, books, that have been found historically that through the process of, quote, creating the books that are used, they just opted not to use certain parts. And to me, it was intriguing, certainly from a Christian perspective, given that was my background, that many of the books that were created by women were not included. None of them were included, you know, in the final product that we see in use today, not the least, which was there was a rewrite for the evangelical community in the 1940s. There's a whole, you know, documentary that's out there that talks about this, and it was a reinterpretation and the introduction, you know, of basically, you know, same-sex relations are a big no-no, when that's not actually in the original text. So we have seen this manipulation of what we believe to be the truth that has happened through time. And, you know, people are just doing it to, quote, create the advantage. So that's why within, say, the Catholic Church, we still don't see, you know, female priests and being able, you can have lay women, you know, practicing and, you know, helping with service, but they cannot be ordained. Yet we have seen other religions such as Church of England and others who now are much more open and they're much more inclusive of realizing that carrying the word, carrying this interpretation is not restricted to a particular identity. It is actually multifaceted. And perhaps in the future that we will see rewrites and reinterpretations that will bring in a much more blended understanding, even though that's not where we're at today. And again, this is not history that's a day in the making or a year in the making. This has been hundreds of years in the making. And that's why we assume it to be, as it is, binary, when in fact, none of it actually is.
Yeah, I think you'd probably trace it back even further. You know, you think about the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. It was the men were generally off to work, i.e. fighting, swords, shields, defending or attacking.
Right.
Women, childbearing, nurturing, caring, and those gender roles are starting to establish, you know, before the birth of Christ, you know, the mythical sort of like zero AD sort of time. And
it's, yeah, absolutely. Sorry, keep going.
Yeah, so yeah, it's. I don't think it's modern Catholicism or modern Christianity that is these gender roles have been ingrained in many societies, mm-hmm. just down to the fact that many women bear children, therefore their role is more nurturing and home-based. Many men are the hunter-gatherer, the killer. They go out, and you can almost see that mirrored in animal wildlife type roles as well, where there are kind of evolutionary gender roles. Maybe sometimes, you know, in the lions, the females do the killing and the males do the lazing around, but overall protect and procreate. So there's slightly different roles, but there are generally fixed roles that have been evolved. And I guess as a human species, we fell into that kind of, that sort of same sort of thinking, I guess, in our prehistoric times.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think in prehistoric it was, quote, as articulated in the same way. I mean, I'm rereading Mary Beardy's Feminist Manifesto, kind of understanding, you know, the power of women. And when you look at that, she makes an amazing statement that was news to me when I first read it. You know, when we go back to about 4000 BCE in the Greek world, there was a Greek philosopher who wrote the original, if you will, role of women document. You know, so that puts it at about 6000 years ago. And literally everything you just talked about is what was embodied in that document. And it's from there. So if we want to trace it back, at least from a written evidentiary based process, it probably started 6000 years ago, because the Roman Empire came after the Greek legend. So Rome was basing itself on all of this previously articulated role and responsibilities, you know, of the genders within that perspective. And yet it wasn't true. It was just, in that case, that philosopher's, his opinion of what it should be, but it's been taken as, well, that must be what it's like. And therefore that's how we see society today.
And then around the time of Darwin, where science was becoming kind of evolved, scientists, male scientists, tried to look for evidence to prove history, if you like. And, you know, there were studies where people, men and women, were having their skulls measured, mm-hmm. and their brains weighed after death to prove that the male cranium was larger, therefore the male brain was larger, therefore it must be more superior to the female brain, because the female heads are smaller, the skulls are smaller, and the brains weigh less. So therefore, there's the proof that male brains are superior because they're bigger.
Well, if that's true, then if we go all the way back to some of the prehistoric peoples and so forth, they had larger skulls and larger brains, but that did not make them necessarily smarter and so forth. And again, it's just this advancement. And, you know, one of the aspects that we have to be careful of is that when you start reading reports and research, you really have to kind of question, well, you know, what was the question they were trying to answer? Because it's really convenient to ask the question and get far enough back to get enough data that proves your point. Well, then you don't need to go actually check all the other data. And we stop, and then we create an interpretation. And when that becomes dated, and again, you know, tens of years, hundreds of years, thousands of years old, you know, it's no longer questioned, when in fact, when you become aware of this perception that there's this disconnect from this modern interpretation, from the historical perspective of human beings, you realize that there's a massive disconnect that is disadvantaging people today because of what's happened before. People haven't changed. They're still diverse. It's just our understanding has become limited because we have gone back to your initial point. We have gone back to those boxes when those boxes were never true in the first place.
Yeah, I think I read a report. It was the World Economic Forum, that every year they produce, amongst other reports, the gender equity or gender equality guide, mm-hmm. or report. And I think if you compare where we were now to pre-COVID, mm-hmm. gender equity has actually gone backwards by, I think, 10 or 20 years. I think before COVID, it was 99 years in the Western world to achieve gender equity, or in the world. And now it's like 120 years. So yeah. COVID set back the advancement of equity around gender by 20 or 30 years, just by the fact that the experience people had during COVID impacted women disproportionately harder for various reasons, such as childcare, home admin, mm-hmm. the man being as a perceived breadwinner and the higher earner,
yep.
needing more access to the table, the desk, the free time, mm-hmm. to not be bogged down with the children. So we talked about inequity of the past,
yeah.
but getting equity in the future is a real uphill battle. You know, 100 odd years for equity. I mean, really? Do we have to wait that long?
You know, I use the comparison, if, first of all, I mean, if we think of it, there's been equal pay legislation in the UK for slightly over 50 years. And yet we know from, you know, the reports that we see, we're not seeing it, right? It's still an 83 pence to the pound for women. And again, not all women are equal. If you are a Black woman, you are making less than that 83 pence. If you are perhaps of South Asian or of Hispanic origin, you are making even less again. So we know that even within women, there is not an equality to that, let alone that, you know, the women's rights movement is well over 150 years old. And while we're in the fourth iteration of, you know, feminism 4.0 and fighting for our rights associated with that, I look at an interesting statistic was the population of Black people within the UK is about 11%. And again, that's using the census from 2022. What was intriguing is I was reading a report that said, in order to get parity in senior leadership, which is a lot of the work that I do with organizations, if we want to get that parity for Black people in that role, by the way, they need to hit two more people to be given the role to hit parity. Based upon the current trend of how many leaders actually make it to that most senior level and are Black, it's going to take about 235 more years. So the whole challenge of equity, I would suggest to you, for all marginalized people, women just happen to be the largest group of marginalized people, but for all marginalized people, when we start looking at the statistics from that perspective, it creates very horrific stories to reflect on, which is why the importance of organizations need to do the work today to change it. Because we know, for the most part, we don't see it happening within society or governance of society. What we do see is organizations who are taking a stand and saying, we got to do something about this. And we fundamentally believe it as a core value of our organizational culture. And they start to do something in order to move the needle forward. And in doing so, when enough organizations actually do that, they also will move the society needle forward in the same regard. So society is always trailing to the most leading organizations. But at the end of the day, nobody's doing it perfect, and it's always a work in progress.
So you talked about the society there and the workplace. You can't escape society and the patterns in society. But if you look at just, I suppose, the aspirations young women have in their teens, they don't aspire often. Often they don't aspire to become scientists, leaders, whatever. They aspire to be mums. They aspire to be doing low level, low paid, unskilled work in many cases, which is why we often see many women in those roles. And again, impacted by COVID. So how do we change? You know, you talked about moving the needle. How do we move the needle in creating a society where young women and girls aspire to their potential?
Well, a couple of things. First is, you know, I would challenge a bit of the language that you used in making the referral, but I'll put it in context. When we think of that conversation, the challenge is not that low-level work is being done. It's that on the basis of feminism 4.0, it has, in advancing the feminist movement, which includes all genders, by the way, which is why men are welcome in there to help move that needle. The key is to realize that feminism 4.0, the quote-unquote new elements, are inclusion, which would include women like me and many others in that definition. And secondly, the intersectionality that comes into play. When we look at those factors, a woman choosing to stay home and become a stay-at-home mom or wife, that's not low-level work. That is her choice. That is what the power of feminism has created, is the ability for her to choose to do that if she so chooses. If she doesn't choose that, you know, then we get to, you know, you were talking about some of those industries which fall under the STEM, S-T-E-M, or STEAM, the inclusion of the A, depending upon how you define, you know, that particular market segment. And when we look into the STEM space these days, the reality is that there are many careers in there that are not geared for the roles and responsibilities that are put upon all women, and especially those young women who might be moms or, you know, starting out perhaps a married life. And in doing so, it is society that is creating the devaluation. The jobs themselves are not of low value. It's that there hasn't been. And that's the importance from a societal perspective when we talk about creating societal expectations of a living wage. That is to remove that bias associated with that work. And it's getting to places like a living wage allows everyone to be able to hold their head high and not be doing, quote, you know, menial work. It's not menial. It has value, and a value has been assigned as the ability to live within society. And in doing so, whether that is stay at home, whether that is go to work and make, you know, some more money, whatever that is, that's really, you know, some of the big challenges from a gendered perspective that we face. And we have to get rid of these biases through education and awareness and, you know, realizing that there are some women doing work that they don't want to be doing because they don't have another choice, because of something like not getting, having a living wage forces them to have to make other very difficult decisions in their life. And it in no way demeans them as a human being, nor the work they're actually doing, regardless of the perception. It is our own bias that's creating that perception. It's not an actual fact.
It sounds easy. It sounds easy.
Everything sounds easy. Doing it's the hard part. And
yeah, so what are the barriers? Why aren't we making a significant dent? You know, we've been at, you know, fourth wave feminism has been around 10 or 12, 15 years, I guess, since I started talking about it. Even third wave feminism, we haven't really, you know, as you said, moved the needle. What are the big barriers? What's stopping organizations and men and empowering women and driving this forward? What's the barriers?
Well, you know, the barriers are bias and these perceptions that we were talking about, that believes the world's supposed to look or work one way. And that's why, you know, in a lot of groups that I'm involved with, and, you know, certainly working with a lot of women's ERGs, BRGs, employee networks, the conversation about how to bring in male allies in support of that, not to diminish the male role. I mean, at the end of the day, every organization should have a cultural understanding of trying to create an inclusive workspace where every employee belongs. That includes their men, their women, and, you know, every other person that may not fit within those definitions. And so the reality is that what we have to do is get together to start overcoming all of these biases and perceptions that hold us back. And the realization that, you know, that we have to start shifting it. And again, I would suggest to you that at a social level of society at large, that's hard to do, really hard to do. You know, the government's part, whatever the government is, it's not a question of politics. It's a question of, are the policies in place that are creating the supports necessary to actually move the needle on these things? And in doing so, organizations are much more at the forefront of having the flexibility and the ability to actually define it. So, you know, we have seen many things change across, you know, many nations by looking at leading organizations that have influenced government by being early adopters of change. And by doing so, they kind of shine a light on how to do it by figuring it out. No one's doing it perfectly. So that just means even the early adopters are still learning and adapting on how to move it forward. But if you don't have an intent to do it, the conversation never starts. And you go, oh, this is too difficult. Well, you know, why are we going to talk about it if it's so difficult? Because, well, you know, that's like looking at, you know, Mount Everest and going, well, that's kind of tall. I don't want to climb it. Well, until you actually try and get to base camp, you know, which is already, you know, putting you, I think, you know, a few thousand feet up, you know, you haven't even begun the journey. It's, I always use the quote in a lot of my work, that one of my favorite quotes is, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step. But if we don't take the first step, the journey never begins. And the problem is we take the proverbial one step forward and half a step back. Because, oh, hang on, everybody was upset about that one step. Yeah, we have 999 more steps to go, but we're fighting over the first step. And that prevents us. Organizations, because they're microcosms, can create that change much easier. And in doing so, we get enough organizations doing that, that can create the influence to take the next step. And it is a journey of steps. It's a journey certainly well beyond the years that I have left on this planet. But I feel that, you know, I am called to do this work in order to move the needle, just because of the disparity that I encountered by simply flipping my binary and realizing that one day I was treated one way and the next day I was treated so marginalized that I was struggling to have my voice heard, even though I had a table at the around the executive table. Or the fact that I'm the subject matter expert in the room, and yet because of my gender, I get completely ignored. Or the fact of the moment we all walk out our front door and not feeling safe. It's not about walking down the high street in the middle of the day, surrounded by people, or riding the tube. It's every aspect of life. And we are impacted because of our gender in every single instance. And the assumed rules that were put upon us. And that's what we're having to overturn it. I can certainly tell you that as a woman over my 50s, you know, learning that I'm becoming invisible within the corporate space, certainly as an employee, you know, was absolute despair. It wasn't that I became less useful or less smart or less productive. I just became invisible and I was no longer seen as an asset. Yet that doesn't happen to men in their 50s. They're looked at for their leadership and so forth. So that's just, again, those gendered perceptions that aren't reality. Women have not become less valuable. They have not become less productive. They may work differently. Things like the menopause certainly cause women to have to, you know, work differently. You know, if a younger woman, you know, probably in her 20s, 30s, she may end up having, you know, childcare responsibilities and social. And don't forget that in between there, you have the sandwich generation who are not only looking after potentially children, they're looking after aging parents at the same time. Where's the adaptation to ensure that we're getting full value, especially when we talk about leveling up and wanting to get all of these people working? Well, guess what? You can't have a homogenous single way that, quote, everybody works. Everybody is different. Everybody has different requirements. And that's really where the equity question comes in. It's how are we equitably addressing all of these diverse and unique needs? It doesn't mean you need 3 million different ways to do it, but you can't have one. And, you know, we see that challenge today, definitely in the corporate space, where there's all this, quote, demand to return to the office kind of working because of, you know, many reasons. Some have validity, some don't. But the ultimate reality, like many business decisions, is it's driven by money. Many of these corporations have signed long-term, you know, lease rental contracts with properties. The property market is a huge valuation that underpins the entire, you know, business community. And to go to where we were during COVID and realize that, oh my God, we could actually have these completely distributed workplaces and we don't actually need this physical space had such a huge economic impact that, you know, the quote cost of living crisis and so forth we see today is nothing compared to what would happen if the corporate financial markets began to fail. And that's really the level we're talking about. And it's how do we keep moving away? How do we keep doing it? Well, let's not force everybody back to the office. Let's allow choice. Some people want to, some don't. Maybe it's a 1 day a week or a 2 day a week and you work it out. It's not always a Wednesday. You know, maybe this person can do it on the Monday and the Thursday. Like, why do they have to be there? You know what I mean? Like, you start to have all of these different aspects. And again, I'm not being overly prescriptive because every organization is different. Their employees are different. And the idea is every group has to look at what their people need and create the necessary solutions for them. And it's not going to be uniform for every company everywhere with one blanket perfect answer wrapped up and tied with a bow.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, a lot of your thoughts on RTO, return to office, mirror my own. So, you know, we talked about bias, ingrained bias, centuries and centuries, millennia even, of gendered expectation, mm-hmm. gendered roles. So our leaders of today and leaders of tomorrow have to have this, have a cognizance of this bias, of this inequity, mm-hmm. baseless and foundless inequity that exists between genders. So what else, you know, if you were talking to an organization around first steps, what can the inclusive leader of today who's focusing their initiatives on, we're talking about gender today. I mean, obviously there are other characteristics, but focus on gender. What sort of steps should they be putting in place, or should the organization be thinking about today?
Well, you know, the first place to start with is, do they have the data, right? If you're going to make organizational level change, it helps you focus your efforts if you have the data. Many organizations are not collecting the data. Many organizations have incomplete data. And those that are trying to collect data are still getting very high rates of did not disclose, i.e. employees have not decided to disclose it. And typically, that comes down to the psychological safety they feel within the organization in order to actually make those disclosures. And so if it's not truly a safe workplace from their perspective, then you're not going to get that information disclosed. And therefore, how can you actually measure whether or not you advance this? And, you know, it's akin to, I'm sure your listeners are aware of in the news, it was on the BBC News last night, I think it was, and they were talking about the NHS wait lists and how all the people that have been referred to specialists are no longer counted on those wait lists, yet they're still actually waiting for cancer care, for heart treatment, you know, for some very serious health conditions. And so it hasn't actually gotten better because now we're muddling with the numbers. And so let's just capture the numbers. And you're not going to get the numbers unless within organizations, unless you create safe workspaces, which is an aspect, an outcome of the work companies do to create intentional cultures. And so we have to go back even to the beginning of that and look, well, where do organizations, once they're trying to collect the data, when they're not getting the data, the answer is it's a question of corporate culture. And where in the culture is there a disconnect? It could be they say everything right in the whole bit. If they're like many organizations, and all you have to do is read a lot of the labor tribunal reports that come out. One's definitely related to gender. I typically read quite a few of them. And in doing so, what we see is there's a very common practice of, oh, well, an organization did a great job defining their culture and they had training on their culture and they launched their culture project and the whole bit. And that was it. It was like, well, this is the project for this month, this quarter, this year. They did it and it's one and done. Well, a culture is lived every single day. I always say a culture is defined from the top down, but it is lived in experience from the bottom up in an organization. And so the work to create an intentional culture cannot be a one and done. It exists as long as the lifespan of that company. So when they begin a project, if that company is going to be around for 50 more years, they have 50 more years of work in order to keep creating that intentional culture and ensuring that every person that experiences that organization or enters that organization or leaves that organization can talk about that cultural experience that they wanted. That's what creates psychological safety. And obviously there's many, you know, sub aspects. I am not a specialist in psychological safety, but I have done some work specifically related to the transgender community within workspaces and how to create psychological safety while preserving psychological safety for everything else. And the fact is, this is very complex. It's not simple. There's about 14 different layers to it. And that's kind of the work that organizations have to go through. And that is where I come in. And in each organization, once we kind of get a baseline, it's about guiding the organization through this journey that is not one and done. I always say, as a consultant, I can help them define it. I can help them, you know, start to deliver the education, but I can't live an organizational culture for an organization. They have to. So I can help put them on the path and the direction, but if they're not living it, they're going to deal with it. And guess what? The tribunals have found that where there are gross violations typically ruled against the organization, it has been that an aspect of culture has not been continually reinforced and trained and retrained through the life cycle of an employee. Again, it's not one and done. You have to do this ongoing because your culture of your organization is going to mature, much like your understanding of diverse genders may mature. And in doing so, you have to reflect that in the language and interpretation of your culture. And so it's not one and done. And as we go through that cycle and somebody says, oh, well, I want to address it for, you know, women, and I want to address it for, you know, Black or ethnic minorities or any particular group, whatever they're focusing on, they're going to learn something, and that has to be reincorporated back into the culture. And that's how they will slowly create psychological safety that gives the data. And in doing so, they've actually moved the needle in doing that, because they've been doing the work before we measure it. They had to do it. And to do that, I mean, there's a whole other conversation about the data and what data do you gather and so forth. But I'll leave that. I mean, hopefully that gives you a sense of, you know, how we go after this rather large challenge, but not insurmountable. I mean, we're human beings. We've done some amazing things. I don't see this as anything less than that.
Are men
Thanks.
Willing and able and ready to step up and do what it takes? Is that part of the challenge? You know, we could talk all days around women's rights, mm-hmm. women's movement, women's having these conversations. But if time has shown us anything, in order to make change, it has to be enabled by people who hold power and privilege.
Correct.
And generally in society, men, mm-hmm. white men, white straight men hold power and privilege.
Correct.
And as a woman, you have to knock on the door gently and be invited in. If you try and knock on the door heavily or kick it in, you get repelled as someone who's crazy or someone who is subversive. So we need fundamental societal change where people who hold privilege see it as their responsibility. So sexism is a male problem. Racism is a white problem. You know, homophobia is a straight problem. So we've got to try and shift where we see the challenge. And women talking around oppression isn't moving the needle, because men need to start recognizing that conversation and have men involved. That's the challenge we face.
Exactly. You know, until we start to realize our privileges as human beings, what I call making the unconscious conscious, until we start to recognize that element, you can't change it. Because see, the process is, you first of all have to make the unconscious conscious. Then you have to accept the conscious thought, good or bad. And then you can decide to change it or not. And then you actually have to do something. And so even that's not a 1-2 step. That is 3 or 4 steps in order to actually get moving to deal with it. And, you know, if somebody is at the top of the food chain, and certainly up to the age of 50, you know, I was a perceived white, hetero, cis man. And I enjoyed every single one of those privileges, because I was in the executive suite. I, quote, had made it. And, you know, I had the salary and the cars and the house and the holiday and the bank account and everything else. But, you know, as Maslow talks about, I wasn't self-actualized by achieving that point in my life. What I did was realize, oh my gosh, there's a huge gap. And that caused me to have to reflect. Well, that exercise, not because of their gender or questioning their perception of their gender, but simply being a white, cis, het male, so cisgender, heterosexual male, you're probably carrying a huge bunch of power and privilege that many others aren't. And until you recognize that and are willing to do something, not to give away what you got, but to uplift others to be in the same space, then, you know, that's part of the challenge. And that was one of my learnings, was the idea of what does it mean to move the needle forward and to advance a bit, quote, within society. Because even within my, quote, marginalized part of my identity, which I consider tertiary to the work that I do, the reality is that I still carry a great deal of privilege. And I carry privilege that many others who have traveled a similar journey to me do not. And I realize that when I'm out in society and, you know, I don't get misgendered, I don't get name called, I have never been, thank goodness, physically attacked, you know, but I do get impacted the way other women do. I have men who try and put their power over me to show that they are, quote, sexually superior or so forth. And create advancement so that I didn't ask for, you know, in my personal space, or that I'm trying to get from point A to B, and they feel they get to interject because, well, it's just convenient for them. Too bad, so sad for me. You know, it's both an aspect of safety for me, but for that person, they don't even recognize the privilege they're demonstrating by doing that exact kind of behavior. And until they're willing to recognize that behavior, that's the challenge. And that only comes from education and awareness raising, which is a great deal of what I do with organizations, because there's still a great deal of education and awareness raising that needs to be done. And, you know, just because someone, you know, had a gender diverse speaker 3 years ago, and, well, you know, they've talked about that topic, they've been there and done, well, get things change, things advance. And so when are you doing the re-education part? As much as we talked about doing it with your development of your intentional culture and training your employees, bringing in the training that keeps your people open and growing by learning is also a key aspect of that. And that's an area where, again, you know, just ask learning and development professionals. They'll tell you that when, you know, the economy gets difficult and the business is hurting, they're one of the first budget that gets cut.
It's fascinating. Hard. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Cynthia, that's absolutely amazing. I can't believe we've been chatting for a little over an hour now, and it's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And I'm sure our listeners have got so much from this. So how can they get in touch with you to find out more about the work you do and to maybe reach out and say hi?
Absolutely. Well, connect with me on LinkedIn. Please mention that you heard me on this show with you, Joe. The other one is they can go to my website, which is www.cynthiafortledge.com. All one word. The name's in the description. So yeah, just go to www.cynthiafortledge.com. You'd be able to connect with me, find out more information, and would love to engage in a conversation if you've got a question that might be burning after this conversation. Please reach out. Thank you.
Thank you. As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. Today's discussion struck a chord. Consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.